Good start to the day.
Just got a lovely shot of Pam. Mike just gave us.
Yeah. Chilling out.
Mike, when you patted Pam just then, it created a very resonant sound.
Did it?
Because you sort of it was just your hand patting Pam.
Yeah.
But it created something, a resonance, and I had an emotional reaction to it, which was to do with just a man and his dog.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was something very, very ancient going on.
This wasn't an ASMR thing. This was more primordial.
It could have been. It could be if I was to ask you to do it for, say, 15, 16 minutes at a stretch.
Whilst quietly whispering to the dog.
While quietly whispering to the dog. It could easily turn into an ASMR experience.
Do I need to be eating sort of barbecue crisps at the same time?
Well, it depends what kind of ASMR perversion you're on.
Okay.
I don't go for mustachioed man eating barbecue crisps. Some people do. A sort of subsection within the ASMR community.
Okay. Well, Pam is now, she's now licking herself all over. I don't know if that's punching through to the microphone, but she's providing a sort of a soundscape. It's quite ASMR-ish.
It's just something.
Let me take the mic.
Oh my god.
Really got that.
My god.
That was disgusting, sorry.
That was absolutely
foul. That was foul.
That was a bit like June too. That was something like that made me think of a sandworm. Of a sandworm sort of suckling its young in a scene that was too disgusting to make the final film. It's a thin line with ASMR. It goes over into gross quite.
Yeah, we pushed it way over. I have no understanding of. I just pushed it way over the line.
That was a stellar but very brief career that Pam had in ASMR, which we've just witnessed the rise and fall of.
There's a thing, isn't there, called misophonia, which is people who can't stand like mouth noises of other people.
Yes. I know someone that has that, and it means that I can't really go to the cinema with them. Oh, because really? my tendency to clean myself with my tongue during
during the trailers
during the trailers is something I like to do to get myself just to get myself nice and ready for the film.
But that little dog sound would have been like absolute kryptonite to our misophonic listeners.
Yeah, I know someone who's like that, and he can't catch a train without getting into a bitter argument with someone.
Oh, really?
Because it's quite a long range, I think. There's always, inevitably, someone on the carriage is busting open their packed lunch, you know, at 7:30 a.m. or whatever.
Yeah.
And he can't handle it.
Yesterday, I went to the cinema to see Anatomy of a Fall.
Oh, yeah.
Huge yay say from me.
Great film.
Oh, my God.
I haven't seen it. Don't know anything about it.
It's on the art house circuit, Mike, so don't worry about it.
Has it got Bruce Willis in it?
No, that's almost one of the defining qualities of an art house film. It doesn't have Bruce Willis in it. So it wouldn't have got through the kind of the Devon sort of...
No.
Well, they would have been... Because there's a kind of redaction system, isn't there? There's kind of Stasi-esque.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have got through.
No, if it hasn't got Bruce Willis in it, then you can fuck off. It's the very clear policy. And it's actually quite nice to have a clear policy from a county council from time to time.
It is, for once. Yeah.
Often this stuff is quite murky, full of caveats.
Yeah. And that's why... there's a black market now, isn't there, in digitally inserting Bruce Willis into art house films and setting them on the side, which will happen around some of the art colleges. Some of the art colleges that haven't been shut down yet.
Well, I really enjoyed The Piano until someone told me actually what was going on there.
Yes, I really enjoyed Manon de Source, the Bruce Willis cut.
Yeah. And normally it's just his head pokes out of a glove compartment in a film.
Just because once you put the money in to get that effect, then you might as well just reuse it, you know. It works. People like it. People are reassured.
Even if there isn't a scene set in the car, they'll fit the glove compartment into. Because you can put a glove compartment anywhere.
People around here are very used to a smash cut to a glove compartment door opening, and then and then you're back in the drawing room or wherever you were
in Shinto Japan.
So Ben, you went to see a film yesterday.
Yeah, I went to see Anatomy of a Fall, and it sounded like you were about to slag me off for it for some reason.
I was. Yeah.
Okay.
So what I'd like to point out is that, because you texted me about this yesterday, you did something which I see as an absolute cardinal sin.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Cinema. Which is A, you missed the beginning, which already for me, I'm not watching the film.
Okay.
Because I'm not going to understand the full narrative arc, am I?
So just to explain, I got in about, I think I missed maybe the first 20 minutes or 15 minutes.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So act one.
Yeah.
You missed the setup. You missed inside, you missed establishing the status quo. So you've got no idea what these characters do for a living, what they're called, what their main relationships are. You've completely missed the setup. So call to action, you've no idea.
I missed the opening dance number.
You missed the Adele theme tune.
You've missed the Adele theme tune. You've missed the stuffed seagull question. Is there a stuffed seagull or not in the first couple of scenes?
Chekhov's seagull.
If there is one, it's likely to come back. If there isn't one, well, if the one does appear later on, it'll be...
It won't be satisfying, will it?
It won't be satisfying. So it'll probably get a three-star rating on Rotten Tom's. So yeah, because Ben, I once fell out with a friend.
Right.
Semi-permanently. The first issue we had was... And by the way, this really date. This is going back. This was going to see.
Was it Steamboat Willie?
No, it was Batman.
Which one? Which one? What are we talking? Keaton era.
It was Keaton Batman. Okay. That's going back a long way. It was Keaton Batman. I remember the specific cinema. It was the Hampstead Heath cinema. It doesn't exist anymore. It's now an M&S.
Great.
Or Progress, as you'd call it in Exeter. Hey. We turn up. We had some issues with parking. I think the fact that we were both 12 and driving was probably. I'm pretty sure there was a parking problem. I don't know if we would have. Anyway, we were basically a bit. We missed like the first 30 seconds or something, and I was furious with my friend for the fact that A, he made us late, and B, he insisted on us staying to watch the film because I was like, no, it's over. The chance is gone. I'm going to miss the narrative arc. Do you know what I mean? Whereas he was like, what's the big deal? So that. And the other issue we had was I once went on holiday to Paris with this guy.
Yeah.
And weirdly, oh God, you know what? I'm starting to put together the story now. I've never really, but basically, so I went on holiday with this guy to Paris.
You've usually given them a nom de anecdote by now.
Okay, let's call this guy Sven Porridge. Okay.
Very clever. Because you just switched his surname and his first name there.
He was always Porridge Sven of the Svens of Hampstead, yeah. And it was Porridge Sven. It wasn't his brother Barley Sven. It wasn't Weetabix.
Or Cousin Gruel.
Nor was it his sister. Actually, I'm just going to have some marmalade on toast, thanks. Sven. Anyway, so we went on holiday to Paris, me and this guy. He did two things which annoyed me. One was he slagged off Paris the whole time.
Yeah.
Now,
a patriot.
A true patriot. So I don't know how you feel about this issue. I think that once everyone is paid up to an experience, e.g. going to the theatre, going to the cinema, going to a country, going on holiday, going to a restaurant, you just have to pretend you're having a good time.
Oh, I totally agree, Henry. I totally agree.
You've got to. Otherwise, what's the...
Yeah. Yeah. If anyone starts slagging off something while you're doing it, you're like, what? What's, no.
What are you mad? What?
Yeah. No, that's
crazy.
This is
why
crazy.
I only go to free admission art galleries.
Exactly.
It's the loophole.
Yeah.
You've got to make the best of it.
Yeah.
That's probably my motto for life.
Yeah.
100%.
Make the best of it. And Mike, for example, if Mike's in a modern art gallery, part of having fun with it, if you're in London, say... Oh, so you've trained Pam to react to the idea of modern art. You trained her so well, Mike.
Thank you.
It's just an extension of you.
Yeah, she will attack strangers, but she knows my take on art. Yeah.
She knows your take on art, yeah. So anyone with a beret, for example, she'll take down, presumably.
Well, it depends. If they're a beret, if they're doing funny caricatures and stuff.
Okay, yeah, that's okay. Yeah. If you like that. Hmm. Yeah, well, Mike, when you go to an art gallery, Mike, a modern art gallery, part of the fun is you go, if you're not enjoying the art, you go, by the way, see that fire extinguisher there? I don't know if it's actually fire extinguisher or part of the art.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to tell these days.
Yeah, and you can do that with escalators, plug sockets.
I don't know if it's part of the art, this. We're going up and down on it. Checking their part.
Stools that people are sitting on.
Jack, that might be these days. Could be fun.
God, you'll stop talking about art soon. Sorry.
Sometimes it's very triggering for Pam. Sometimes I don't even know if my wife's part of the art, maybe. And then you said that joke, didn't you? And then actually, well, turns out it was Damien Hirst. Your wife was actually Damien Hirst, wasn't it? Dressed up.
Yeah.
It was really embarrassing for you, wasn't it? Because he had been part of the art.
It was a durational experiential art piece.
Yeah.
And I had to go off and sit in a cafe somewhere and take each of those words and break them down and try and work out what all that meant.
What the hell it meant.
I was none the wiser.
Difficult day.
So Sven Porridge.
Sven Porridge, he was going around slacking off Paris.
Hmm. And what age? Is this young?
No, this is a bit older. Hmm. So this is, I think, about 20.
Oh.
I think it was first holiday of university. So it was university, but in one of the holidays, I went and did a brief job in Paris for a bit.
Hmm.
And I lived in Place des Abbesses, which is a lovely little square halfway up Montmartre.
Oh, my God.
With a superb...
Amazing.
One of those lovely metro stations, you know, with the Nouvelle Art sort of...
Yeah.
It was so good.
It sounds like you were living inside the sort of movie that Mike would splice Bruce Willis into.
Mm. Yeah, it really was. It was incredible.
You get a great chase scene down those steps, couldn't you?
Oh, you could, yeah. You could do superb chasing. And there were literally cafes and just... beret clad, you know, baguette wielding, attractive young people everywhere you looked.
Mm.
It was superb. And I was a stone's throw from actually fairly bleak red light district. That was Pigalle at the bottom of the hill that I didn't go to. It was one of those weird things where, on the one hand, it was living the perfect, it was a perfect experience in a way. I was living in this lovely little courtyard.
Mm.
And when I go back to Paris, I will try and find it normally.
Mm-hmm. But you never can.
But I never can.
Because it's a CNA now.
Because it's a really, really good CNA. Anyway, lovely flat. Idyllic experience. One drawback was the smallest toilet. I'm trying to get your head around this. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it was the smallest toilet I had or have ever seen since, the one I had to use in there. The smallest toilet I'd ever seen.
It was built for an 18th century Frenchman.
I think, yeah.
And they were mistaken for monkeys back in the day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But not only was it the smallest toilet I've ever seen before or since, it was also the shower.
What?
It was basically a toilet shower. That's how I remember it. Yeah. So to sit on the toilet, my knees were up around my ears if the door was going to be closed. It was that small. Plus, that was the shower. I can't remember how it worked.
It does sound idyllic. You're right.
It almost
just
feels
you
like...
and clod upon clod of sopping wet bogroll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And now I look back at it, at the same time, I kind of feel like there was an opportunity there for me to innovate and create a multi-billion pound sort of super hygiene toilet business. Do you mean? That could have been the idea that sparked. Mm. All you'd have to do is spin yourself around 180 degrees.
Yeah, and flush yourself and you're done. You're ready to go.
If you think about it, a toilet that's also a shower is actually a cleaner story than a normal toilet, which isn't a shower. You know what I mean? It's actually, you could argue it's a more hygienic story.
I suppose in my head, I'm just imagining you constantly flushing it and then just turds coming out of the shower. I'm not sure why, but that's the mental picture.
It's a perfectly
picture.
Circular system.
Yeah. Oh, it was circular plumbing, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, did I not mention that? What was I saying? Oh, yeah, the other thing, there's another gross story. It depends how far into the story I go. It starts not gross, which is Eddie Izzard was doing a gig in Paris at the time. I saw a poster. Mm-hmm. This is how old...
Yeah.
Bit arty as well. Bit arty, yeah, end of comedy, isn't it, Eddie Izzard?
Yeah. Quite imaginative, isn't it, a lot of it? A lot of it couldn't actually have happened. It's so cruel the way you skew a mic in this way and completely unfounded, but I'm still all in if everyone else is. Yeah, I saw a poster, Eddie Izzard. Because do you remember... Eddie Izzard quite famously did some gigs in France,
in
French.
Yeah, in French, yeah. And he's done ones in German since, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was the first one he did of those. Went to see him. Really, really good. Loved it. Absolutely brilliant. I could leave the story there. Is it a story at that point?
No.
Okay.
No, it's just an account at the moment.
It was an account, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'll tell you the bit which involves turds then.
Digestive tract talk. Oh, yeah.
So I went to see Eddie Izzard. I was so excited about it, couldn't I? Just before he was about to start there, I really need to go to the toilet. I was bursting to go to the toilet. I suppose I'd probably been saving them up a bit because of my flat. It's possible I'd been saving them up a bit. Basically, I sat on the loo. I was about to go to the loo. And this is totally disgusting, but there was no loo roll. Right? Mm-hmm. So I made...
a deal with the devil.
I made a deal with the devil that night.
a clean anus, but at what cost?
So I was like, what do I do? I was desperate going to the loo. Eddie Izzard was about to start. What do you do? Do you know what I mean? It was a real crossroads moment.
Hmm. Welcome to What Do You Do with Henry Baker? The latest Scrapes podcast.
It's episode 73, and we're still just going over the Eddie Izzard poof incident. Because we've still not got to the bottom of it.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about what I would do. Mm. It would depend what implements and accoutrements I had on my person.
So I had all the utensils from a French brasserie. Okay. Which I'd swiped earlier in the
day. So I'm flambeing it off.
You've got a flamboy. You've got a flambe option. You've got a selection of like different sized ladles. Ladles within ladles. You could reduce it.
Bain-Marie?
You could Bain-Marie it. No, what happened was I thought, I don't want to go and watch it desperate for, you know, to go to the loo because I won't enjoy it. Mm. I really want to go to the loo here. So I just thought, I thought to myself, you know what? I've never been a gambling man.
I'm going to put it all on brown.
I'm going to put it all on dry poo.
Oh, what you say? Oh, no. Wow.
I put it all on dry poo.
So you gambled on the fact that you wouldn't need to wipe.
On the one.
Which happens for me once every 100,000 times.
It's incredibly rare and very, very special.
Oh, very special.
When it does happen. So anyway, I essentially, in roulette terms, it'd be like putting everything on one number, putting everything on six or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, I had to take off my underwear and use that to wipe my bottom with.
Yeah. It's that all going back into the auditorium with one sleeve, isn't it? Just going to raise more questions.
Even though it was Paris, very cool, very creative place. It wouldn't have fitted in with the rest of my look.
Well, I think Henry, you probably did. So you gambled and lost, and then you did what's the only thing that was open to you, I would.
Yeah. But although I'd never thought of that as a solution, but you find these things when you're under stress. In a way, you work out, you find out who you are.
Oh. But what did you do with the shit stained underwear?
Because that's not getting flushed down a Parisian bog, is it?
Well, let's hope not.
No, that ended up in a toilet bin.
Okay.
Anyway, the gig was absolutely brilliant. I had a lovely time.
Good.
And didn't miss any of it. So
anyway, as I said, I went to the cinema this week.
And then I still haven't told you one other thing. Which is, no, I haven't told you the other reason I fell out with that friend.
Okay, yeah, okay. I thought the other reason was that he was slagging off Paris.
No, there was another reason.
Okay.
We were late to get a train to Euro Disney. Mm. We were running late.
Yeah.
And he refused to hurry along to get to the train because he had a holiday pace that he walked at. Wow. And he refused to walk beyond his holiday pace. He said, I'm walking at my holiday pace.
Wow. Oh, that's unbearable.
Yeah.
Is that why you're such a rigorous timekeeper now, Henry?
Exactly. That's where it comes from, Mike. There's always a backstory.
Yeah.
There's always a reason.
That's mad, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a really odd thing to do.
It was really odd and annoying. Anyway, Ben, can you, for the love of God, get this story out? Go on.
Well, it's not even much of a story, but... Yeah. So as I said, I was late. We missed the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And as you say, Henry, there's a decision to be made. Do you just give up on it? Has it gone? Mm. Or do you just watch the two-thirds of the film that's left? I was with my partner. She was very much, I think she was kind of the view, like, we can watch this another time. Like, this is done.
Yeah, that's what I would have said, definitely.
But I said, no. As we rush from the car park to the cinema, I will read the first third of the Wikipedia plot summary at you.
Oh, what a splendid way to enjoy cinema.
But okay. But
Henry's struggling with this.
But actually, do you know what? So I don't know, any listeners who've seen the film will know this. In the film, there's a big incident that happens that I missed. It's the fall, the titular fall.
Okay.
Yeah, everything stems from that.
But then basically the rest of it is kind of like a court case interrogating what happened.
Yeah.
And so unwittingly, I put myself in the point of view of the juror. who hadn't experienced or seen the event, but was prosecuting it.
Yeah.
And so I think I hacked the movie and made it better.
Well, I think you've demovied the movie. You've turned it into an actual court case. Yeah. You've changed what the movie is.
Yeah. Because you could make that argument about quite a few movies, couldn't you? And you're point of viewing it from a sort of incidental character. If you just an hour late, stay for 7 minutes. From the point of view of the ferry operator who briefly sees Jason Bourne.
Anyway, I enjoyed it. And the reason I brought it up is because, misophonia-wise, it's quite a quiet film. Mm-hmm. There was only four other people in the cinema, and they looked arty as hell, right? Mm. They were Cardiff's creme de la art.
Asymmetric hair.
Yeah. Little sort of tiny glasses. Little tiny one. So we're talking about art again?
Pam doesn't like this. Why haven't they got normal haircuts?
Trigger warnings. Sorry, Pam. I didn't give you any trigger warnings. I'm sorry, Pam. They can't help it. One of them lives in London.
The great thing with Pam is I didn't have to instruct her anymore. If she sees anyone with dyed purple hair, she just attacks them straight off the bat.
She can handle a blue rinse, but that's as far as she's willing to go. It's okay, Pam. They're virtual. They're not really here.
So, yeah, so arty types, they like maybe like someone with like a couple of fairy dice hanging off their forehead. It's weird. Isn't it creative?
Yeah, one trouser leg is a grandfather clock.
Yeah, very big in East London at the moment, that.
And then kind of the other end of that same spectrum, like just wearing black, you know what I mean? Like cool. Yeah. So I felt that these were serious people and they were watching their serious movie.
Yeah.
But I did want to eat my huge picnic of popcorn magnums and a chicken sandwich that I bought from Tesco on the way.
Ben, can I say?
Yeah.
If I'd been your partner last night, I'd have been absolutely crawling up my own rear end in embarrassment. Not only are we turning up late, we've missed the narrative thrust of the film.
He's got a chicken sandwich, though.
With a chicken sandwich. He's got a chicken sandwich, to be fair. Actually, maybe they were sitting there thinking, oh, damn him, of course he's going to see it like from the juror's point of view.
He's hacked the movie!
He's hacked the movie. Why didn't we think of that?
This is real art house. Here I am sitting here with my dry ice coming out of every orifice. It's just an affectation.
Anyway, so the problem was, as you say, it was quite embarrassing to come in so late. We're obviously oiks. What happened was then, obviously, normally you open the food during the trailers and nobody minds. But once the film's going, if you open food, it just sounds awful.
Yeah.
And then you're at a crossroads. So my partner's very much of try and slowly open it over the course of 25 minutes.
It can be done. It can be done. It's very tense. It's not, again, you're not probably enjoying the film quite as much as you should be.
So this is bereft of helicopter explosions to snap open a panini packet.
Well, that's why those were all initially put into films, wasn't it? Explosions and helicopters and stuff.
Of course, yeah.
So that people could get their Krasnacks open. But yeah, much harder in an art film, isn't it? I've done that, the slow motion crisp packet open or whatever. It's about controlled pressure because you need huge finger pressures to do that. But controlled.
You're never doing as good a job as you think, though.
No, that's true.
No, and it's just annoying for like 20 minutes for everyone there.
Yeah, rather than 5 seconds.
Yanking the plaster off sort of thing might be best.
Well, that's sometimes. So that's me. I just bag, crunch. Concentrated 10 seconds of like...
Yeah,
and get it over with. But I can't work out which way is the way, but that's my way, is what I worked out yesterday.
Tricky, Ben, really tricky. It sounds like you've really covered yourself in shame.
Well, I had a great time. Let's turn on the bean machine. This week's topic is sent in by Lewis.
Thank you, Lewis.
From Lewisham.
Okay.
Bit confusing.
So it's the Lewis, it's King Lewis of Lewisham.
King Lewis.
Is olives.
Okay.
Oh.
My initial thought is that the olive is the traditional bedfellow of the continental cured meat.
Yeah.
Very much so. Yeah. They do a sort of flirty dance, don't they, with each other on the platters of the B&Bs and hotels of Europe, don't they? Between 7 and 9 a.m.
It's richly symbolic, isn't it?
Richly symbolic, isn't it? Yeah. The ham, of course, represents the simple farm wench, and the small, bitter olive is the
corrupt baron.
The corrupt baron's son.
who's had his centre bored out by a machine and filled with a little pimento.
Yeah. Because he failed to cover himself in glory in battle. Isn't it? That would be the punishment.
When do you reckon olives landed on British shores in terms of, like, I wouldn't call them an everyday snack necessarily, but, you know.
Because they're ubiquitous now.
I reckon olives would have taken about 500 years at minimum to break down the British palate and to get people, because I think just initially they're just disgusting, aren't they? It's just like, what is this foul nonsense?
Yeah. I think for centuries, most people, a British person, if they'd been taken to a place where there were olive trees growing, they would have just assumed this tree is dead. We need to chop it down and burn this field and evacuate everyone who lives within a 10-mile radius of it.
Yeah, before it spreads.
And while we're here, grab those urns.
Because they look lovely on a little museum I'm setting up down the road.
You know what? Imagine some daffodils in that urn. Be lovely. Next to a wheelbarrow full of ham. That would look lovely.
Full of ham and Mesopotamian scrolls.
I think ham is the British olives.
Ooh, oh, that's interesting. A strong take. That's a very, very strong take.
And it's shaped history.
It has been said, hasn't it, that if you want to invade Britain, the first thing you have to do is set fire to all the pigs. Which is really hard to do.
Which is why technically it's still legally imperative for farmers to keep their pigs wet, isn't it? From sort of Napoleonic era.
You'd always see, they're always wet, a pig.
They're always wet. They're always outdoors.
Mm. And we've taught them to wallow.
Exactly. They think the way you eat food is you get into a big trough full of swill and sort of writhe about. That's how they eat.
It's just for a sort of defence statute.
Keeping them wet. Because obviously it's much easier to set fire to olive groves, isn't it? Which is what you would do if you're invading, you know, Italy or something, or Greece. Is it the Romans did that? You trash all the olive trees because they take like 70 years to grow or something. So you're absolutely clusterfucking the local community's ability to have cheese and wine do's and have like finger food. They can't.
So the elite dies off in weeks.
The elite dies off.
You try and do a book launch without olives.
You can't do it.
Yeah, so the intellectual class is got rid of as well, yeah?
Yeah.
You're just left with the proles.
And you leave some pigs there for them, so the proles move on to the ham diet.
Yeah,
they become sluggish. They become easy to control.
Yeah, yeah. They become sausage-like, sausage-fingered, sausage-brained. That's where the phrase sausage-brained comes from. Olives, I think they're one of those things where, but I think I imagine a medieval person in Britain seeing an olive would just be like, "Is this the way a witch gets around? she compresses herself into this vile pod." Let's cut it open and see what's inside. Yes, it is a witch. It's a hard, little, horrible witch.
That cannot be killed.
Cannot be killed or reduced.
By earthly means.
It's like an atom. You cannot subdivide the pip of an olive without blowing up the whole country. No, but because it's so, by a lot of metrics, it's incredibly crap food, isn't it? And I think, you know, like the wisdom of children. Mm. I think that's why children know.
The olives. I mean,
no child likes olives. But we kind of drill it into them, don't we, that olives are, and gradually we convince the adult that olives are an acceptable food. But a child is just looking at it going, this is by any metric a crap food.
A waste of my time. The yield is small, the taste is foul.
The pip to flesh ratio is the biggest piss take in the food kingdom. Isn't it? I mean, it's basically all pip. It's not clear whether it's an animal or a plant.
Don't call it a fruit. You're about to call it a fruit, Henry, and that would really upset me if you called it a fruit.
It's actually technically a fruit.
No!
Yeah. As are pigs.
So, both of you, big question.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Green or black?
Black, I would say.
Oh, Mike.
That's very classic, Mike. I like that. That's because that's an intense man's olive. That's
Is
not...
It?
Yeah, that's
not messing around.
No,
yeah.
But it's also 80s pizza olive.
Yeah, 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 big time. Yes,
please. So, no, yeah, you're right. That's what it is. Yeah. It is 80s pizza olive.
Yeah, and I do need to be served on a pizza, and I will eat around it.
You return them to the restaurateur at the end of the night, do you? In a little envelope with a thank you note inside. Yeah, and that's the way we did it in the 80s.
And they can reuse them the next time I'm in. That's fine. Put my name on the packet.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's a bit like shot in a partridge or game bird. Yeah. If you accidentally got it in your mouth, you'd spit it out instantly, wouldn't you?
Otherwise, off to see the dentist the next day, aren't you?
So, Henry, green or black?
I would generally lean towards the green because the black is quite bitter. I see it's a bit like coffee. It's a bit like the blacker it is, the more dark and bitter it is. And it's, I feel like you have to train your palate over years, over a lifetime, to be able to eat a really intense black olive and enjoy it. So I go for the milder greens.
Well, in Italy and Greece, on your deathbed, you're given the final bitter olive, aren't you?
The final bitter olive.
And that sends you over the edge.
Yeah. Huh. And if you start to make a recovery after that point...
Well, you're bludgeoned to death. Because you're too powerful.
You're bludgeoned to death with the...
with olive branches. It takes a long time.
Ironically, because it's often seen as a symbol of peace. And if that doesn't work, then they will, again, ironic way, they'll shove a live dove down your throat. Won't they?
An ironic white flag up your ass.
It's a white flag. If that doesn't work, they'll ram you through with the pipes of peace. But what I will say is I do like black olives as well. And I was actually going to ask, what's in your olive cupboard?
Oh, I've got some olives I can get.
I've got some olives.
Should we do live olives?
Let's do live olives. Oh,
have you all got olives?
I expect so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Gonna hear Mike getting in his car.
We're going to the airport.
So we're playing What's in Your Olive Cupboard?
I've got the Lidl Meadow Fresh Olive Trio.
Oh, okay. So there's a... You've got a... What's the trio? I can see black olives and green olives there. What's the third?
So on the back it says pitted Calamon olives, mm-hmm. pitted green Halkidiki olives, mm-hmm. and pitted green Halkidiki olives filled with red pepper in a red pepper dressing.
Mm. So those have all been found in a meadow, is that what they're saying?
Meadow fresh.
I'm going to challenge that as a concept because I've been thinking, what is an olive? Okay. It's not a traditional crunchy vegetable that's crunchy when raw. Mm-hmm. It's not a grape.
Yeah. You don't boil it.
You don't boil it. So what the heck is it? I think it's occurred to me. Is it not like a pickled thing to some degree? It's sort of treated. I mean, it's not. What I'm saying is, it's not. If it was meadow fresh, it would be inedible. I imagine you can't pick an olive off a tree and eat it, or can you?
I think you can. I think it would be wonderful.
Can, yeah.
But
yeah.
Don't they all just sit in vinegar? That it's a vinegar infused something.
I think that's what we've got used to here.
I don't know. I literally just. This is what happens when you don't know. But feel the need to speak.
If there's any olive farmers who are listening,
let us know.
And can give us a Pompidou discount.
In Puglia.
I once went on holiday to Greece and there were some hot olive trees and the olive farmer was beating the tree with a massive sort of paddle and all the olives were falling out. It was brilliant.
Wow. And there may be people from Italy that have had a similar experience on holiday in Britain and seen a farmer whacking a tree with a paddle and loads of pigs falling out. Which is a lovely sight.
Henry, what are your olive du jour?
So I'm packing a jar. Mm-hmm. I've gone for Kalamata. Mm-hmm. Authentic Greek.
Lovely.
So these are sort of, they're kind of black olives actually, but they're closer to kind of...
They're a bit purpley.
Purple, mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
What have you got, Mike?
I've got similarly, I have a jar of your black pitteds right there.
Oh, those are, they are, and they are pure black.
I've also got a jar of your black Calamon with...
Oh, I'm on the Calamon train as well.
Pippin. I've also got a tin of green Manzanilla Picante.
Oh,
well done. Good range.
And I'm also going to throw in, just for good measure, a little jar of black olive tapenade de Manavadou.
Oh,
yes, please.
Nice one.
You've got a very smooth, full olive cupboard.
Olive paste.
So basically, it looks like Mike's just won What's in Your Olive Cupboard. Well done, Mike.
Oh, thank you.
Right, I'm going to eat one.
I'm going to eat one.
Misophonia time.
Achilles, I will fight with you this day. And I'll see you next in Valhalla. Even though that's a different mythos system. Give me my smallest, skimpiest set of armour.
Yes, the one with the six-pack on it.
It's just a codpiece and some spurs. You know the one.
It does make me want to put on some of those little gold shin pads they would wear, pair of sandals, mm-hmm. big sword.
Winged headdress.
Winged headdress. Mm-hmm. And
slaughter some priestesses.
Yeah, because the oracle decreed it. And maybe, you know, after the battle later on, go on a date with a swan or something. Have it off of the swan, see what happens.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Beget some sort of swan demigod that's going to probably, in a couple of millennia, come back and do for you.
And it'll be in the form of a child born with the head and body of a human, but the neck of a swan.
Mm-hmm. And the intellect of a swan.
And the same reaction to small dogs of a swan.
My olive review of these Meadow Fresh Lidl olives is that they taste like a cheap buffet at a works event.
That's what I've gone for with my selection. I went for one of the pitted black. Mine very much were, abandoned buffet section of European continental breakfast buffet.
So they're both buffets that have been laid on by institutions which are up against it financially to some degree.
Yeah, and it's a buffet that's been laid on in a loveless way, which is nobody wants a loveless buffet.
Oh, God, I forgot. Can we get the runner to go out and just... No, don't go as far as M&S. There's a place... No, we haven't got time. Just pop... There's a place on the corner. There's a bin on the corner.
So if there's any olives or anything that just looks like there might be olives, no one's going to eat them, so they don't need to be safe to eat. They just need to look like we're serving some olives.
They're going to want to feel that they're going to want feeding.
Yeah, so where are your olives, Henry, inspired you to make love with the swan? And
they really are. Mm. I just feel I'm on the plains of Troy.
Whereas me and Mike are at the photocopier.
I'm half Turkish. There's one element of sort of Turkish cuisine. It's probably Greek as well, and maybe lots of cuisines in that area, part of the world, have this. But there's a kind of glorious combination of flavors that come together that is superb, that I absolutely love, which is black olives, feta cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Tomato?
Tomato.
It's a Greek salad.
Or attack. But yeah, basically Greek salad, let's say. So for some reason, you take out one of those ingredients, it doesn't work. But for the three, it's the kind of...
A bit of basil.
Oregano.
Dirty dog. But no, basil would be good. Or dill.
No. Dill. What are you eating? A Russian salmon roll?
You chuck a bass in the middle of that. Nonsense.
The whole thing is being eaten off the back of a massive sea bass that's alive while floating in the ocean. It's the most intense olive experience that's known.
Dill.
If you eat just feta cheese, it's too salty. Mm. Olives
are also a bit salty, aren't they?
But it has a kind of sour quality, and then the tomato kind of freshens it up, and it creates this kind of virtuous circle of just like beauty in the palate. It's lovely. Absolutely love it. But a black olive by itself is... Oh, I've just eaten two and enjoyed them, but it's a bit much. But they just all complement each other perfectly, and then it's really good.
I would say Greek salad is on my weekly sort of lunch rotation. I'll have one a week.
Really?
Is it? Yeah. Oh,
it's a good. Yeah. It's an excellent meal that takes sort of 4 minutes to make.
You could even bung a little bit of red onion in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Cucumber?
Yeah, a bit of cuke, yeah.
Yeah, bit of the old cuke.
I don't like cucumber. Because when I was a teenager, I had two African land snails, those huge, big snails you can get. Yeah. And it was their favorite food. And I just associate them with snails now, so I can't eat it. Because they were gross.
Mystery of Benjamin is solved.
The origin story.
The origin story of Benjamin.
Pets he was horrified by.
Benjamin origins. Or bonjerins. Benjamin bonjerins.
To begin with, I didn't feel they were gross. Then I remember there was just like a moment. There was a kind of like turning point. One day I just looked at them and I was like, those are fucking gross. And they live in my bedroom.
Yeah. And what age is this?
12, 13.
Very formative. Yeah, this is the origin of Benjamin. Yeah. And then you look out of the window and you're going, in a way, people are snails, aren't they? just without shells, and they've learned to put on shirts.
Just feet that keep going all the way up.
Just feet that cut. Just feet with a haircut.
And then they hibernate. So when it got to December or whatever, they went into their shell.
And you'd just be thinking, please don't wake up. Please don't wake up.
They didn't wake up.
Coincidence?
Nothing I did.
No.
But it was so sad.
Yeah.
And because you can't tell if they're dead or not, you just have to wait to see if they're going to come out. And they just never came out.
They never came out of their shells.
Yeah.
Or did they pull off the greatest escape story in modern times?
Let's it's a classic locked perspex case mystery.
Two snails, one snail tank, and one 12-year-old git.
Four tons of missing bullion.
Ding, 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 ding.
And Alan Davis.
Playing the priest. So is it possible, Ben, has this ever been fully explored as a possibility, that the snails, as they will do in an extreme situation, e.g. exposure to a mean with his cucumber 12-year-old git, will escape their shells and look for another dark, cavernous place they can live? Two of them, two nostrils on that 12-year-old boy, two snails.
Oh, no. They're there to this day.
They're there to this day.
I knew I shouldn't have snorted those two giant slugs.
Is it possible, Ben, that they're actually in you right now and they're controlling you from the inside of your brain, and you think you're talking about two snails you didn't like, whereas actually two snails that didn't like you are talking about themselves through you?
You finally understood why occasionally you have the urge to feed a cucumber through your left ear into your head.
Doesn't make sense with that, doesn't it? And also, why Ben didn't turn up to our Cover Yourself With Salt party last year.
Time to read your emails. Yes, please.
When you send an email, you must give thanks to the postmasters that came before.
Good morning, Postmaster. Anything for me?
Just some old shit.
When you send an email, this represents progress. Like a robot shoeing a horse.
Give me your health.
My beautiful horse.
This is from Dr. Jacob.
Hello, Dr. Jacob.
Hi, Dr. Jacob.
Historically, much has been made of the banality of evil. Mm-hmm. Related, brackets sometimes integral to this concept, is cruelty by inattention.
Okay.
This can be manifest, for example, in inaccessible hospital architecture, lazily designed prisons full of blind spots, oblique welfare bureaucracies, or non-functioning government websites.
Yeah, keep it light. Yeah.
Spending the last couple of weeks completing your jigsaw...
Oh, God. Yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah.
My wife and I found ourselves drawn to this dark field of study. Combining the maddeningly similar and arbitrary pieces required the close analysis and anticipation of a plan that soon revealed itself to be no plan at all, just a fluke of whimsy, an accidentally constructed labyrinth, the fart of some unknowable leviathan upon whose whims we are vaingloriously calling ourselves puzzlers.
Yeah. So it's so rich in metaphor, the puzzle. It can mean different things to different people. It's one of those things anyone can read anything they want into it, because it has that quality to it.
We did complete the puzzle.
Wow.
But I fear that the questions to which it led us in our dark nights of frustrated labour will continue to haunt us. These questions about trust, about our foolish impulses, about the assumption of intelligence and the chaos of this world are likely to remain a puzzle evermore. Kind regards, Dr. Jacob.
Golly, what a journey Dr. Jacob has been. And presumably that's why Dr. Jacob was awarded the doctorate in the first place.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. He was previously Jacob, and he's now, he has a doctorate in advanced jigsawology.
Advanced despairology.
Advanced despairology.
We've had a bollocking.
Uh-oh.
This is from, I think, Rafe. R-A-P-H. Mm-hmm. Rafe or Raf?
R-A-P-H?
Yeah. I'd say Raf.
Raf, maybe Raf. Yeah.
Sorry, Raf or Rafe, whichever it is. Dear Beans, I often find myself reviewing older episodes while waiting for the latest Bean release. Upon a re-listen of your Assassinations episode, following a discussion of new metal, Henry suggests that his teenage heaven was, and I quote, 17th century Bach.
Oh, no.
As Mike and Ben will no doubt be aware, the earliest compositions we can ascribe to Johann Sebastian Bach came from circa 1703 or 1704, when he was merely 18 or 19 years old, and crucially during the 18th century, not the 17th.
Yeah, but which you were talking about Bach's great uncle, weren't you?
Bach the Elder.
Yeah.
Sorry, I should have been specific.
He used to do sort of lewd ditties.
He did, well, lewd lute, as we called him. He was the lewd lutester.
Yes,
sorry. And a lot of people like the early stuff of people, of artists, as a way of making themselves cool. I go even further back. I prefer...
Go to the uncle level.
Go to the uncle level of early.
Raf says, unless the teenage Henry had access to a time machine or groundbreaking new musicological research, unearthing pre-1700 Bach compositions before he was 16 years old, I call bollocks to Henry's assertion that he listened to 17th century Bach, and demand on behalf of all music history purists that he accept this Baroque Bach bollock.
Well, I don't accept it. Reflecto bollock. The last few sentences have reaffirmed something I suspected anyway, which is that essentially, because of the way in which we label centuries, 17th century, is that 1700s? No, that's 1600s. It's not clear enough anyway, because I think there he said 17th century, then 1700s. It's not clear which century anyone's referring to when they say 17th. Do they mean the one where each one starts 1700s, or is it the 17th, 18th century, which is the next one? Because we start from year zero, which doesn't count as a number zero, is it? In the same way that it's impossible to know whether you've got... When someone says something's happening in 10 days, it's impossible to know what they mean. Do you know what I mean? Because do you count the initial day or not? That's why it's impossible to actually know for sure if you've got 10 of anything, because are you counting the first one or not? Do you know what I mean? Is it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10? How many things have I just said? I don't know. Because did I say... Do you know what I mean? Do you count the zero? Dude, it's impossible to, especially around the turns of the centuries, early 1700s, it's particularly unclear what anyone's at. You know, it's not an exact science.
Also, if you watch any telly from the early 80s, it seems a bit like the 70s, right?
Exactly.
That's true. And things from the early 90s feel like they're from the 80s, but they're actually from the early 90s.
You get bleed. You get intersectional decade bleed.
Yeah.
If it was early 1700s, is it true? Could we say it's late 18th? It's got late 18th century vibe. We could be saying that. Yes. Would we know what we meant? No. So, and in a way, is that what Bach's uncle's music is trying to tell us? Maybe it is. Maybe it is. So I'd go back to the uncle stuff and I'd give it another listen. And then just keep it to yourself. Don't get in touch again. Thank you very much. No. It was lovely to hear from you. Thanks. It was actually, yeah.
And time for another bollock?
Sure, okay. Why not? Now we're warmed up.
This is from Nicholas. It is with great sadness that I have to deliver a wallop of a bollock to Wozniak.
Uh-oh.
In a recent episode, he stated he would fenestrate an orca with a machine gun.
Mm-hmm. That means, doesn't that mean plant trees all over it?
Well, no, he says technically fenestration would involve putting a window in the orca.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I suggest he may have meant defenestration, which is the favoured way the Putin regime deals with awkward doctors and about 50% of political enemies. Delighted to deliver the bollock. Yours, Nicholas.
Well, he's obviously never messed with Mike. Mike'll stick a window in you in three seconds.
I could have obviously just, you know, cut the orca to ribbons with a machine gun, but, you know, that's not a deterrent, right? I'm talking about deterrents.
Yeah.
Whereas if I send an orca back to its family and I've installed a Velux in it, yeah, and not even using the usual tools, but using the sort of butt of a submachine gun,
yeah,
people at the orcas en masse are going to know not to mess with.
And just
Wozniak, you know, anymore.
If Wozniak does that to you or one of your relatives, just little note. Do register it, because it does have the Velux warranty, but that's only if you register it within the first 2 weeks, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, Michael double glaze your ass. He'll stick a window in you. Who
I'll
do you think you are?
I'll French window your auntie. You know, don't care who knows it.
And he'll open them up and go for a stroll. Mm-hmm. Then come back a bit later.
Yeah, install some curtains.
Install some curtains. He doesn't care.
He'll patio your ass.
He'll stick a car window in your leg.
It doesn't care.
I'll turn your school friends into a conservatory.
You will. Yeah. It's not Harrow rules boxing, mate. You're gonna get glazed.
You're gonna get a porthole where the sun don't shine, rendering it useless.
Yeah, but a nice feature from a design point of view. Yeah. But until your turds start building up against that glass because we've got nowhere to go.
So is that fair to say, Mike, that's a bollocking rejected?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, words are my weapons. Yeah. We know that. Yeah. And I choose them. The idea that I would misspeak. Madness.
Yeah.
Madness.
Reflecto bollock.
At this juncture, we'd normally play the Patreon jingle. We're going to play a version sent in by one of you. This one is so good. This is from Jez and Evie from Huddersfield.
Thank you, Jez and Evie.
Thanks very much.
They write, "Dear Beans, for some time now, my daughter Evie and myself have thought that the reversing sound on my father-in-law's Honda CRV sounds like your Patreon jingle."
Hmm.
"We've recorded the sound from his car and then recorded the great man himself, my father-in-law, Mr. Jeffrey Stott, saying the words." Now, this is even better than I thought it might be.
Okay.
I don't fully understand why do cars make a noise when they reverse now?
Well, vans beep, but it's not that, is it?
Well, it sounds different, doesn't it? It's a different sound quality to the...
Oh, is it?
Anyway, let's see.
Okay. Do you know what
I mean? Yeah, but I'm wondering if it's an electric car and they've put a sound in to stop you reversing into people not noticing.
I see.
Oh, because they're so quiet, aren't they?
Listen, yeah.
Anyway, here we go.
It's time to pay the ferryman. Patreon. Patreon.com/3beansalad.
He's got a brilliant voice.
I mean, first up, great work by Mr. Jeffrey Stott there. Incredible.
Great.
Hats off to Mr. Jeffrey Stott.
Beyond the call of duty for father and all that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Way beyond the call of duty. Superb.
And what a haunting sound your Honda CRV makes as it reverses.
Yeah. That's got to be electro, surely. That sounds like a car of the future.
It's beautiful.
That's outstanding. Thank you, Jess. Thank you, Evie.
Thank you. That was absolutely brilliant. Amazing.
And Mr. Jeffrey Stott.
And of course, Mr. Jeffrey Stott.
They write, "You may have heard of Mr. Jeffrey Stott as he opened the first video rental shop in Huddersfield in 1982. It's that Jeffrey Stott.
Knew it. That Jeffrey Stott.
Yeah, okay.
So, if you like the sound of bonus episodes, if you like the sound of ad-free episodes.
Mm.
Or maybe you'd like to... have a little wander around Film Corner.
Yes. We recorded a new Film Corner, which is our patron-only film ramble podcast.
Where the three of us discuss Dune 2.
It's very unlike other film podcasts, because they will often try and review films when they come out, or just, you know, immediately before.
Yeah. Whereas we'll be when it's just after the buzz has died. But not long ago enough for it to be interesting again.
Anyway, also, if you'd like a shout-out from Mike in the Sean Bean Lounge, you can join up at the Sean Bean tier.
You certainly can.
Mike was in the Sean Bean Lounge last night.
I was as well. There has been a bit of a queue to get in recently. So, Sean Bean Loungers, don't panic if you've not got in. But we did. There was a bunch of us in last night. We had a right old riot, because, of course, it was the...
Well, it was the non-obscene Grecian urns night, wasn't it?
Thank you, Henry. It was. And here's my report.
It was non-obscene Grecian urns night last night at the Sean Bean Lounge. The evening was held in the east wing of the lounge, which Francis Rayner had melted down and refashioned into a gigantic events urn, equipped with toilets, kitchenette and CD player, for which she was awarded the Sean Bean Top Bastard Medallion and a lifetime supply of Sean Bean. Nicholas Sutcliffe presented an urn which wasn't obscene but could have been construed as obscene in a thick fog, and so was castigated, ejected and generally made an example of, simply to underscore the point that the Grecian urns were meant to be non-obscene. Robert Creamer, Tegan Wren Rose, Adam Cann and Emily Ward presented an urn depicting a scene from a holiday they all took in Whitby, but not together and not at the same time. Poppo presented a narrative urn in which the hero, William Ned Blake, did battle with Dr. Joey J-Dog for the sacred Marks and Spencer's Fleece of Gavin Elstead, before being tempted by the funky bassline of Guzzle and Faff, by the forbidden fruit of Stephen Ayers, and by the forbidden fruit-flavoured yoghurt of Max Tweddle, after which he sought counsel with the oracle of Yoni Evans, who advised him not to go into caves with the offspring of Zeus and a bull, with the offspring of James Irwin with an I and a bull, the offspring of James Irwin with an E and a bull, or with strangers. Alison Eardley used an urn to recreate Fall of a Birdman, also known as Episode 6, Series 2 of Bergerac, and instead of painting, collaged Sean Bean Lounges onto the urn. David Robinson appeared as a young John Nettles, Dan MacDonald as a young Celia Imrie, Catherine Page as a young Donald Sumpter, Alex Marsh as a young Richard Griffiths, Joanna Fallon as an old Richard Griffiths doing Ruby Anniversary DVD commentary, and Barnaby Girling, picture-perfect as Terence Alexander's rapscallion Charlie Hungerford. Nathan Miller and Colin J. Broadbent's urn showed the mating process of the heron, this being the least obscene avian mating process the urn was allowed as educational. Bethan R's urn about the history of urns was felt to be strong meat by Harry Kidd, dangerously subversive by Frederick Yesson, part of a conspiracy involving the CIA and Honda by Kerry Flynn, not as good as the original book by Rhys Main, and it reminded Barnaby Britton of his primary school head teacher. Jordan Arshad won plaudits for attending as a non-obscene Grecian urn, having been hollowed out by Jack Fackley using Lawrence, given handles made from the legs of Matthias Hall, and glazed by Laura Butterbean using a solution made of TJM and soda feldspar. An optional lid was constructed from Team GB synchronised lid silver medalists Alan Martin, Amanda Dochin and Peter Hagemeyer. Mark Allen presented a Gresham Grecian fusion urn. Esther Kate, an urn depicting instructions for playing the ancient Greek equivalent of a five-string banjo. Ash Richardson, a ready-salted urn. Harry Bingham, an urn with a trap for making smaller urns disappear. And Bridget, an urn you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. Mark Duncan made an urn in the image of Becky Duncan before realising he already was an urn made by Becky Duncan in the image of himself in a case that's ongoing. Elsewhere, finally able to use their long sidelined catchphrase, "There's no I in urn," Chris Miller, Freddie Armstrong and Ginger McGarrity showcased a team effort urn that would have put the 1975 Pittsburgh Steelers to shame. Least obscene urn, yet with something of a wink and a nudge, went to Tess. Dan Watson received a special commendation for his magic eye urn. And Karen Martin Bond took home the gold for the fastest time to escape from a very large urn that's full of lots of much smaller urns. Thanks all.
So that's the show. We'll finish with a version of our theme tune sent in by one of you. This is from Graham in Florida.
Oh, thanks, Graham.
Blimey.
He writes, long-time listener, first-time emailer. I've been meaning to send in a version of your theme tune for a while now, but I haven't been sure what it should be. Then it hit me. Your theme tune is perfectly suited to being played on a set of boomwhackers. Mm. Boomwhackers are a favourite tool of music teachers. They are plastic tubes tuned to various notes when they are hit against the knee or hand. A set of boomwhackers has a range of notes due to their varying lengths. So please find attached my boomwhacker rendition of the theme tune.
Lovely.
Yours, Graham from Florida.
Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Graham.
And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yes. Until next time.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.